Oh, we've started. Oh, okay.
Oh yeah, we're just jumping right in. What are you doing? How's it been?
It's been a minute.
It's been a long time.
Yes, there's a lot's happened since the last time me and you had a little chit-o chat.
Oh yeah. Yeah, the last time we had it up on the YouTube channel, and you announced to the world that you were having a second child, and now they're well in the world.
Well, let's put it this way. That just shows how long it's been since we actually had a conversation, because that is 8 months ago.
Yeah. Okay.
Eight months.
We can mark time with that, right?
That is, I'm pleased to say she's doing very, very well.
Awesome.
I say the both are.
Wee Neelix.
Yeah. So, Alanda.
Oh, Alanda.
Alanda. Right. Alanda. Yeah. So. And a lot's happened on your end as well, because the last time I spoke to you, you could eat meat, or red meat.
a lot has changed. Yeah, that is definitely a new event. But it's all worked out well on my end. I am absolutely healthier than I was before it became a problem.
Good.
So, I'm reaping the benefits of well-behaved diet.
Good to hear it, my friend. Good to hear it. And it just goes to show as well, to enjoy the things that you have right now, because you never know when those things are going to be taken away from you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, if you've got a hankering for an indulgence along those lines, be sure and get all you can, because like JJ said, you never know. This snuck up on me big time. Well, it was probably in the mail for a while, but I just ignored all the signs that led up to it. And, the check needed to be cashed at some point, I guess.
It took me by surprise when you told me as well, because I just, for initially in the first stages, I could not get my head around a redneck that couldn't eat red meat.
Oh, I know, right? It was a bit frustrating at first. In the consultation, the nurse also made sure to include that, that meant that I couldn't eat rabbit and squirrel and such. Since it is the South.
What so about possum? Is that that off limits as well?
That's off limits. Mammal meat is what that. Well, I should say more specifically fatty meat, but something. Mm-hmm. But it's easier to get lean, fish and poultry. So
I'll tell you what. There's nothing wrong with being healthy, and like you say, at the end of the day, you're embracing the new you.
Yep,
that's a brilliant thing,
I've lost a little weight.
Yeah, I'm
kind of a lot of weight. Actually, I'm frustratingly 1 pound away from 50 pounds. So it's been that part of it's been easy. So, but you guys have moved house, right?
Not yet, no. But okay. We're in the process of moving. So, for the benefit of the listeners at home. The room I'm in is a bit of a mess, because I've tried to get everything sorted and packed, and anybody that's moved house knows it's a big undertaking. We're hoping to be moving towards the end of this month, into December. So it should all be
busy enough
before Christmas. Let's put it this way. Christmas is cancelled, not only for, because of COVID and all that sort of thing,
right.
But it's, financially it's cancelled as well. That's happening. That's on the cards.
I just bought a suit. We literally just got back from buying a suit for Noah, the oldest. He's a senior this year, and so he needs a suit for a lot of things coming up, a couple dances, and then, when you're at that age in life, you just need a good suit of clothes. And I spent I think the suit of clothes cost more than Trisha's first car. But that was also, in 1993, so 92. So, but it was a shocking amount. And I played it cool, though. I was like, no big deal. But now I'm going to sell plasma. So...
So you guys really go to town with these with the high school thing, don't you? I mean,
it's a big dancers, culture, yeah.
I mean, it's not really been that big over here in the UK. I mean, some schools do it, and I think it is starting to catch on, the whole prom.
Yeah, like a social.
It's never
thing.
really Yeah, it's never really had the gravitas that you see with you guys in the States, where it's like limousines, expensive suits, dresses, all the, you know, the singing, dancing, you know, it's a case of keeping up with the Joneses.
I would expect, you know, and I haven't, this is me just speculating, go based on what I've seen and what I know. But I think it is, you know, it's similar to, or it's born from, debutante balls and things like that, you know, and that was a big thing in the South, you know, in the antebellum South, but, where, you know, the young ladies were presented at the debutante ball to find a suitor. And, I imagine that culture just transmogrified into the prom homecoming culture that we have. But you guys also don't have these, I don't think, as much of the school centric sports culture that we do.
No,
like high school football is huge here. That's what homecoming is, right? So we celebrate the homecoming game, which is usually, you know, I guess we've played an away game and now we're coming home. I don't know why we call it that.
But no, you're right. You're right there. I mean, we don't have that, as you say, college football, which just to translate for any European listeners, that's basically university, isn't it? Sort of college football and
American football,
which is rather confusing. I mean, let's be honest, we're both Trekkies.
Yeah.
As many people know. And I listen to the Delta Flyers podcast, and both Garrett Wang and Robert Duncan McNeil are always talking about football. And they both, I think more Robert Duncan McNeil than Garrett Wang, but they follow college football teams.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of like, that's
it's
like
a religion.
Going up to Edinburgh. I mean, we have school football teams and rugby teams, and there is actually an American football team in Scotland. They do play it, but it's not as big as what. And we'll get onto that in a minute, because actually there is something about that I could mention in a bit.
All right,
but yeah, it's like for us to go to a university or a college, a college or a school football or rugby game. And putting all, I mean, we go to a field. That's literally all it is in high school football, soccer, if you will. It's just a field.
No stadium, no bleachers, anything like that. Yeah.
Oh, whereas you know the stadium. I've seen some of the stadiums of the
in Texas, especially. Oh no, high school football in Texas is millions and millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars. There are some high school football stadiums in Texas that cost as much as NFL stadiums have. It's insane.
It's what I know. You know what? I personally love it. I mean, I really do. But just to segue off for a second, it's rather appropriate that I'm actually talking to you today.
Right. We mentioned that. You mentioned that earlier. What's happening on your side of the pond today?
We're looking after your Mr. President.
Hail to the chief, because you better start a hailing. There's a movie.
Yes, Mr. Biden.
What was that movie called? It had James Garner and somebody. There were two former presidents. Gosh, I can't remember, but it was funny. And one asked the other, when they play Hail to the Chief, did you ever have lyrics for it? And he was like, yeah, it's Hail to the Chief. You better start the hailing, because here comes the Chief. It's like, oh, that's perfect. So, yeah, you got to see Air Force One, or the plane that is currently serving as Air Force One.
Yes. It was, to be honest with you, I mean, this is something I've always been fascinated by. Aviation in general. Mm. I've always had a love affair with a 747. I've been lucky enough to fly on a 747 by accident, it's a lovely plane. It really is. I've been lucky enough to see one fly into Edinburgh previous to Air Force One. But when I found out that he was flying into Edinburgh, it was like, I've got to see this. I really have to see this. And there was quite a big turnout when he eventually turned up. Because the problem with going out to see Air Force One is information is very far and few between.
Right.
And exactly. And any accurate information that does make it onto the World Wide Web is very quickly disappeared.
Uh-huh. It gets done away with. Yeah, no doubt. How does that even happen?
So basically, you have to rely on intel from people on the ground, fellow enthusiasts, aviation enthusiasts from around the world. So in this instance, he was flying out of Rome because I believe he was there for the G8 summit in Rome.
Oh, cool.
And they were flying out of there. So the original plan was it was supposed to be 0030 hours local time in Edinburgh on Monday morning. So get this. This is how much I wanted to see this plane. I was working Sunday night into Monday morning on a contract hire for the COP26 conference, which is happening in Glasgow at the moment.
Oh, nice.
So basically, for the first half of my shift, I was essentially a standby vehicle. So if they needed any extra movement for the police, so we're basically moving the police around the central belt of Scotland to the various locations in which they needed. So I'm sitting standby. I'm not doing anything. Nothing's happening. I'm not getting any phone calls. So I actually go with my coach. So I'm back on private hire charter work now. So I'm not on the transit anymore. Mm-hmm. I should have mentioned that. People listening probably don't know what we're talking about.
I know. You do. Right. I know. I'm in the know.
But yeah, so...
He keeps me in the loop, y'all.
So basically, I take my coach to the top side of Edinburgh.
Take my coach, please.
Yes. Take my bus.
Also, please.
And I'm in the strange situation where I've got my bus parked at the side of the perimeter fence of Edinburgh Airport in the middle of the night. Sat on the side of the runway waiting for Air Force One to land, only to find out that it was delayed and it wasn't going to arrive till the following morning.
Oh, man.
But it didn't matter to me anyway because I was sitting standby. I was getting paid. And, you know, I wasn't doing anything until 4 o'clock in the morning anyway, so right. It filled the time for me. But so when I found out it was arriving at 11:15 local time. That was literally just about half an hour, 45 minutes after I finished work. So I took my bus back to the depot, cleaned, washed everything, back home, picked up Neelix, went out, because we live like right under the flight path for Edinburgh Airport.
Oh, right on.
So I picked up my son, went out to the banks of the Firth of Forth, or the Forth Estuary, if you will, and sat on the banks there and waited for it to come sailing in, and it was it was well worth the wait.
Did you get to watch it?
Definitely. Unfortunately, because I wasn't because of the time period, I didn't get the chance to get up to the airport to see it because, as you can imagine, a plane of this celebrity is going to attract a lot of interest a lot of interest. So I would not have got anywhere near the fence. Yeah. At any of the points, because there's about 5 or 6 points where you can go and see the planes in Edinburgh Airport. And I would never have gotten anywhere near it because of the amount of people that would have been there. So I just thought, yeah, I'll go somewhere where I know I can see it. And I watched this thing flying in on its final approach, because it literally, like I say, is on the final where, you know, where we can see the planes. And yeah, it was a beautiful, I think, I don't know if I sent you the video. Yeah.
Send me a picture, but maybe not video.
I'll send you the video. It's not a brilliant one, but it's there.
It's enough.
So yeah, and I've only ever gotten emotional 3 times when it's come to something in the realms of transportation.
Right.
The first time where I got all emotional was. I don't know if you've heard of, most people have around the world, because it is a famous locomotive, the Flying Scotsman.
I think you might have educated me a little bit on it, but I think tell the listeners about it. And also, just a quick reminder, transportation, obviously, someone who drives coach, or as we would say here, but it sounds more glamorous the way you do it, but we call it a bus driver, even if you're driving the big fancy buses. But transportation and the technology around it is something that fascinates you, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
Trains being one of the things, especially.
Definitely, definitely. So yeah, the first time was the Flying Scotsman, which is, to put it into perspective, is a little bit like, similar in celebrity to I'm just trying to think now. I think it's Pennsylvania. It was the Streamliners, stuff like that. The Big Boy would be a better, actually, example.
Right.
The Union Pacific Big Boy. It's one of those things where it's celebrity just by its very nature. The Flying Scotsman was the first steam locomotive to be taken in for preservation. It did a world tour. It actually went to America at one point.
That's a lot of shipping.
Yeah. The guy that owned it at the time wanted to basically milk it for all it's worth and basically took it on a tour of America, which was not very successful on account of that it could go to America, but it was not allowed to operate in America publicly.
So it couldn't be on the rail. So
it could be on the rail, but what it couldn't do was carry passengers.
Oh.
So they couldn't take it over there, and they couldn't operate tours and whatnot like they do with the Southern Pacific do on a regular basis to Cheyenne for the rodeos and that. Mm-hmm. That's something I really want to do, by the way. I forget what the name of the train's called. It's got a name, forgive me, but it's the one that goes to Cheyenne for the big rodeos down there, and always wanted
to
do that.
Life goal.
Yes, it is one of the life goals, yeah. Going back to that, it took it on the tour of America, and it was just a case of just driving it along the tracks, turning up at town, showing it off. And as you can imagine, when it's not making any money there, it was losing money.
Oh, of course, yeah, if you can't charge for passengers.
He actually, while he was, it was unsuccessful the first time, it went back a second time. But when it went back a second time, he went bankrupt, or the person that owned it went bankrupt while it was over there. So somebody had to buy it while it was still in the States and ship it back.
Wow. Wow.
But if anybody's interested, I mean, I could go on forever on that, but if anybody's interested, just search Flying Scotsman America, and you find YouTube videos and documentaries about it all over the place for it. But so when my 18th birthday, I got to travel behind this locomotive for my 18th birthday. And I always remember we were coming round a long curve on our way to a seaside town called Scarborough. And I was at the back of the train, and I had my head looking out the window, enjoying the scenery and getting all the atmosphere and that. And then I just see, as the train banks around to the right, I'd see the locomotive then just wells up. You know, it's a bit like, I'm trying to think of the best way, a comparison, what makes you well up and stuff like that. But
having seen a space shuttle launch, the last space shuttle launch, I think I can empathize.
Yeah, yeah, that would,
Hugely, an unequatable emotional impact that you... It takes you aback as a person to have this emotional feeling about a machine. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't matter that yours was the train and mine was a space shuttle. The feeling is the same.
It's the same thing.
Why do I love this thing that can't love me back? Right. And we do that. We do that to these things of ours. We impress upon them personality and other things that we as humans need for our own connection. But, you know, obviously an inanimate object is very much Commander Data, TNG era Commander Data, not movie era, because, he's incapable of feeling, And that's how the machines are. It's sad. Like, I love these little Transformers in front of me, but they don't love me back. You know, they're just plastic. Are you there? Where'd you go?
I lost you for a second there, Dan. I don't know if...
I got you back.
Right, happy days.
Woohoo! But yeah, you know, the machines can't love us back. And that's okay. That's all right.
No. And the thing is, like I say, that the space shuttle is a... I mean, I've never actually seen one other than on television. I can see, you know... I mean, I can see exactly... It's exactly the same thing. It really is. So the second time I got emotional about, you know... I say an inanimate object, it's far from inanimate. It's got life, exactly. It's got personality, you know, right. It moves, it breathes, you know. But the second time was the first time I ever saw Concorde up front personal.
Yeah.
I never seen it fly. That's the only regrettable thing.
Oh.
I never got to see it fly. I always wanted to travel. That was a life goal. That will never happen, unfortunately.
That whole fleet.
Due to the tragedy. Yeah, due to the tragic circumstances in Paris. So that will never happen. But just a few clicks down the road from where I live, there's a aviation museum that has one of the Concordes. I believe there is two, possibly three. I know there's two in the UK, one at Duxford, and one... near Edinburgh. So I went to see this with my son and my mother and father, and it's in this hangar, and I remember walking in, and bearing in mind I've never seen this thing fly, I've only ever seen it on TV.
Right.
But before, I had this preconception of all the what it was, what it meant to humanity, what it meant to technology. You know, I mean, how significant it is in human technological history, what this thing did and what this thing meant and what it could have done if it wasn't for red tape. But walking into this thing and you just walk into the hangar and all of a sudden it's just right there. It fills the hangar. And it's just this almighty feeling of, my God, there it is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There, you know, that's, I am standing underneath a piece of history.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It is. And something similar was my visit to Kennedy Space Center before the launch. But they have one of the unused Saturn V's hung from the ceiling in one of the buildings. And it's very much the same, but it's separated into its stages with the computer the interspatial computer cores and things like that, and like you said, you're just like, you know, this thing did,
it's like in
this
awe.
this thing moved, and not, you know, if the listener, which, you know, our demographic for the audience of this podcast is probably aware of what the Concorde is or was. But if not, it was the only commercial passenger supersonic jet in service for it wasn't long enough, but it was what, 25, 30 years? Didn't it go into service in the 70s?
Yeah.
I was fascinated by it. I was just fascinated. It was a beautiful, beautiful plane. Trapezoidal angular intake, jet intakes, and the angled nose because, you know, it was so long that it could pierce the air. You know, this thing is like a civilian version of an SR-71. It's just a gorgeous plane.
JJ said,
it's such a a representation of human technology at its peak. When we did things that we weren't supposed to do.
It's one of those few things in human history that has happened, has been and gone, and is recognized as a moment, as a reference point. Because even now, people make reference to one-offs or like, for example, I'll give you the Bugatti Veyron, for example. So Bugatti, for those that, you know, don't know, because not everybody knows all car manufacturers. I mean, I didn't for a while. I didn't even know Bugatti existed until this thing came along.
Oh, right.
But the Veyron is basically a supercar with 1,000 horsepower plus.
Ooh. That's a lot of horsepower. It has
two W12 engines. It goes like it's the fastest road legal car in the world. Or it was. I don't know if that's been beaten or not.
I can't imagine the sound of 1,000 horsepower.
But the this thing was referred to as a Concorde moment because Bugatti is owned by the Volkswagen Group, the VW Group. So basically, when they were asked, you know, what was this all about? It says we wanted to do it. We wanted to show that it could be done. We wanted to prove what was possible.
Oh yeah,
And they did, and they did.
And sometimes that's just that is the engineering for the engineering's sake of it. Is you know, that's what led to the Titanic, but also what led to this, you know, this amazing sports car. It just reminded me, you know, how close I am to the train. Just a moment ago, I don't know if you heard. It's singing a song on the way by, but the train is just blocks away from the house. And it's all, that seems to have been the case my entire life. I've lived very close to the train tracks. I don't know what that says about anything.
I would love to, at some point in my life, go over to the US, to see the railroad system, hopefully before it, you know, before it changes beyond recognition.
There's a tunnel here too.
I see these things, these big locomotives, and I can just imagine standing up against one of these things and looking up.
Oh yeah, they're huge, and you know, see two or three of them stacked together as they're pulling a, you know, mile or two worth of freight. It's awe inspiring.
There's I'll have to see if I can find the video on YouTube, and I'll send you the link. There's a locomotive that was built for the UK by when it first was built, it was Electromotive Division (EMD), but then it eventually became General Motors. But it's known as the class, we call it the Class 66, but it's based on an engine from a US locomotive. And it was built originally in Ontario, Canada. Ontario, Canada, or Erie, Pennsylvania, Ontario, Canada. And I think it's built somewhere else now. But there's a video of the locomotive for the UK market being switched out of the factory by a US, you know, US standard switching loco. And basically what this thing was being pulled out by was essentially a yard engine, what we call a shunter. You guys call them switchers, pulling a UK mainline locomotive out of the yard, and the thing was dwarfed by the switcher. I mean, it's just that if I can find the video, I'll send you the link so you can see the comparison in size. The difference is massive.
We make a big train.
So much so, actually, that we do actually have a US style switcher here in the UK. It's operated by a company called Foster Yeoman in the Cotswold. So there's a massive quarry down there in the Mendips, and they actually have a switcher down there, and it's, like I say, it's a proper US, you know, loading gauge thing. It can never leave the quarry because it's too big to go anywhere else.
I was going to say, it might rip up your rails.
But it's gone off on a tangent there for a second.
Well, that's what the show's about.
But, Going back to Concord for a second, you do have one on display in the US as well, which I believe is in New York City. I don't know if there's anywhere else that's got one.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's, what's the aircraft carrier that's...
Right, is it is that the Nimitz?
I think, honestly, I wouldn't...
It's a museum ship that's docked in New York, and it has a space shuttle there as well. So one of these days we could go see them both.
So, yeah, I mean, if anybody wants to see what it, you know, what this thing is and what it was, and you, if you're ever in New York, go down and you can see
check
one.
It out.
There you go.
Check it out.
Thursday.
I'm fortunate enough that when I do get to go back to Kennedy, because we go to Florida pretty often when things aren't COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And so the next time I get to go and visit there, Atlantis, which was the last shuttle launched, is on display at Kennedy. So I will get to see the shuttle that I saw launch when I get to go back. And I'm pretty excited about that. That's just, you know, how it is, man. It's just going to be special.
On the subject of shuttles and whatnot, a friend of mine has very kindly letting me watch through For All Mankind with him.
Mm. Oh, yeah. That's a great show.
Oh, my God. Oh my God, why is Apple holding this to themselves? Honestly, this thing needs to be out there.
It deserves to be in the broader world, doesn't it?
It does. This thing, I swear to God.
And it's got deep Trek roots too.
Oh, the references, mate. I mean, I'm only into a couple of episodes of season two at the moment because I'm catching through, but
yeah.
It's wow. But I learned things because my friend's been telling me that a lot of the stuff, even though it's alternative history, a lot of the stuff in there, a lot of the characters are real life characters based mm-hmm. on real, you know, the real people that were involved in the space program. And I learned through that program that there was meant to be more shuttles.
Oh, yeah.
There was,
yeah.
You know, there was meant to be a dozen more. With all sorts of names like, I forget the names anyway, but there was a few, and there was a, you know, lovely ones. But yeah, I mean, that was just brilliant, and I'm looking forward to, you know, finishing the series because I'm what's your policy on spoilers, by the way, just in case anybody's, well, I'll tell you what I'll do.
Yeah, spoiler alert.
Literally got upset when a certain person who spent the first entire season behind a desk
mm-hmm.
and eventually went up, you know who I'm talking about now,
mm-hmm.
And then went up to space, first time up into space, and, you know, something rather unsavory happens. I was like, oh my God, I like this character. I've gotten invested in this character and now he's dead.
Yeah.
And also, by the way, the interaction with his co-pilot when she comes out to him.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And like everybody's like expecting him to be, oh, it's okay, it's all wonderful and all that. And he's like, whatever you do, do not let this leave this.
Yeah, you don't tell anybody else, and that has some implications going forward too.
I'm looking forward to that, but yeah, so there's that one, and it's the Next Again episode, I think, come out. So anything past that, don't spoil it for me. I'll spoil it for everybody else who haven't seen it, but don't spoil it for me.
No spoilers past that point. I will say though that the Trek Connections, you know, it is produced by Ronald D. Moore.
And the Acudas are involved in that.
Yeah, exactly. The set design, a lot of that, well, technology design, stuff like that, are with the Acudas, who, you know, deep roots with Star Trek there too. And
what I do like about it is the attention to detail.
Oh man, it's very well, done.
Because for example, the spacesuit.
Mm-hmm.
So when the Russian is in Jamestown Base. And you see his subsuit, if you like. Mm-hmm. You see all the piping.
Yeah,
all the piping for the cooling
system and stuff.
You never see that in sci-fi. You never see that in movies. You never
That level of detail.
It
takes too hard. It's too hard to do, right? No, and it's an incredibly well-made show, and well-written all the way around.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, the character development is brilliant. The investment is brilliant. And I say I just love it. But swinging back round, I'll swing this bus around. We've missed a couple of stops here, so we'll go back and pick them up. So the third time we're talking about emotional reactions to the vehicles and whatnot. So the third time was actually, to be honest with you, I'll take that back because that's a little bit of a poor thing to say about Air Force One. Is, you know, when I seen the plane coming in, I'm like, I've idolized this thing.
Yeah.
I've seen it in movies, although to be honest with you, what you see in the movies is completely and utterly inaccurate.
it's movie Air Force One. And not the movie Air Force One, which is also a movie Air Force One. And a terrible CGI crash.
Oh, honestly, the best scene I've ever seen in a movie, Air Force One, was the one in Independence Day when they're banging it up the runway and everything's
blowing it's so up behind great. Yeah. Them. Oh yeah, that's it's a hero. It's a hero of the day.
Oh,
it takes off just
hero
fine.
Moment. Brilliant. Yeah. But yeah, seeing it coming in and it got closer, and I'm like, there it is.
There it is.
There it is.
Hanging in the air like bricks don't.
I mean, some of my colleagues, when I was telling them that I was going out to see this thing, it was like, it's just a plane. They're saying, it's a waste of money. It's a waste of money. That's a whole debate for a whole podcast.
That's a different thing.
Podcast.
It has nothing to do with the plane itself.
But I just love what it represents and the fact that it's a symbol. It's like the Houses of Parliament. It's like the White House. It's like the Taj Mahal. It's more than just an object. It's more than just a building. It's a symbol of a culture. It's a symbol of, I mean, if you like the freedom of what America, you know, what America is, if you come subscribe to that, because I know some people don't. But it's an icon. It's an image. It's an idea. You know, because just like the fact that it's only Air Force One when the president's on it.
Right.
I can't remember what its call sign is when it's not. But yeah, everybody calls it Air Force One because, you know, it's the idea.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the image. It's the. And so this thing comes in, and I'm in absolute adoration of it, and, you know. And I'm like, oh, this is amazing. I finally got to see it. So we goes up to the airport to go and get some photographs, as you said, I sent you a photograph, and to see it parked up. And again, that same reaction, even though I'd just seen it 20 minutes prior, flying in the air, when I went up to the side of the airfield and seen it again parked up, wow.
Yeah.
That same reaction. The reaction to the second plane, which follows it around, the 757, was, oh, okay, I didn't know that existed.
like the adjunct office.
So I asked a friend of mine who's really into his aviation. I says, what's the 757 for? He basically turned around and says, well, that's for all the people that Joe Biden doesn't want on Air Force One. That's coach classes, you would say.
Yeah, those are for the lackeys that don't want to get.
But, we've funny. Had one of the things that's been quite prevalent on Twitter and Facebook and stuff like that here in the UK is the fact that he's come to a climate conference.
Right.
You know, and in order to get him here, it's required 2 C-17s to bring all the kit into Edinburgh.
Mm-hmm.
Air Force One, the 757, which I don't know what the call sign was, so if anybody knows that, by all means, let Decker know, and he'll let me know. So you've got the 747, the 757, what would be Marine One. That's right. Also in Scotland. Cargo. And I think there's there's a standby one as well. So there's two of them.
For the
I believe the I believe there's a couple of Blackhawks as well that are on standby or that
and
are
you know,
assigned
of, beasts.
If need,
you gotta have the beast.
Yeah, yeah.
And the decoy beast.
You've got all the you know. Honestly, the amount of kit and technology for one man.
It's a lot.
I mean, it's a lot. It is a lot, and I mean. You see some of it because there's planes from all over the world in Edinburgh, Glasgow, you know, for all the world leaders. So there's the Israelis came in with a 737. The Canadians came in with an Airbus. Yeah. The Australians are here. They've got theirs. There's Nigeria, France, Germany, you know, all the... and they're all coming in on chartered passenger lines. So El Al is the Israeli flag carrier. So they're the ones that brought, you know, with a 737, they brought their delegates.
Right.
And so on and so forth. So the only two people that have a, I mean, the other countries have used like military jets. So nothing that's been modified, nothing that's been specially produced for transport.
Oh, yeah.
It's just,
yeah.
You know, off-the-shelf military equipment or off-the-shelf civilian equipment. So the only two people that have got something specific is Joe Biden with Air Force One and our very own Boris Johnson, who has his own plane as well now.
Sorry that rubbed off
which
on
is,
y'all.
Which is really ridiculous, because up until a couple of years ago, they basically used a regular Royal Air Force 737 or 757.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then all of a sudden, they decided, I want a paint one with a massive Union Jack on the side of it.
Well done. Yeah. That's not. There are a few things that you shouldn't take from America and. Over the top, bigger than needed is one of them. We do everything go big or go home here, including our airplane, I guess, for the president.
So I mean, there is the issue of the Royal Train, for example, which is about the closest thing Britain has ever had to something like Air Force One.
Right.
So there's always been, since Queen Victoria, a Royal Train, but. About 15 to 20 years ago, the royal family decided, well, this is a lot of money. What can we do to offset that? So basically they turn around and says, well, we can hire it out for corporates. We can hire it out for delegates. We can hire it out for other duties other than the royal family.
Right.
So they started doing that. I mean, it doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen. And imagine Air Force One being hired out.
Yeah, no, that would never happen. Well, you know, I won't say never because we thought a lot of things would never happen, and here we are. So,
I mean, one of my beautiful facts I know about the is that there's not just one 747. There's two.
Yep. Always a backup.
Oh, actually, no. There's actually three. There's a third one, or there was a third one, but you know how in the movies, I mean, this is what I've been told, so I'm only going off of information that I have, so if it's incorrect, I do apologize.
Send an email.
But I was told that there was a third aircraft, and I've seen this referenced in a documentary as well, so it kind of confirmed it. But this third aircraft is, you know, in the movies when all hell breaks loose and they go to DEFCON 1 and the president flies off. Oh, and it's always in Air Force One. It's always in the big Bluebird, right? No, that's not the one they would use. They would use the third aircraft.
Smaller.
Which is unmarked. No, it's a 747, from what I've led to believe. But it's unmarked. It's not, you know, It's not livery. Got all the regalia, livery or whatever.
Yeah.
And I've heard it referred to as the doomsday plane.
Oof. Well, I mean, you know, if anyone has a contingency plan along those lines, it's us.
So it's basically
and Putin, probably.
Pray to God you never see the president flying that thing.
Why is the president flying on a completely white, unmarked plane? Uh-oh.
Yeah, we did.
Oh, that's, yeah.
We did.
Mm-mm. I tell you what. well, look, man, I have another topic that I want to get into, but we'll get deep into the woods into it. I no doubt you've mentioned it briefly before, and it's something that fascinates me. But your interest in in extraterrestrial encounters and those sorts of things, that's a whole show that we're going to have to come back to. Let's do like a 15-20 minute thing on it real quick.
By all means, fire away.
So, lead me in. I'm not sure. Like, I, you know, in the for myself, it's a statistical absolute that there is other life in the universe than ourselves. That's just there are two. It's too vast. The math eventually works out. Whether or not we are advanced enough or close enough to one another to be able to interact, or if there's a way to overcome the time dilation of near light speed travel, or if there's a subspace thing like that, you know, who knows? But I also ascribe to the fact that there's a whole lot of things that have found their way into our air space and onto our crops and such that have some of them are explainable. But there's a vast majority of them that are also not quite explainable, I like to think of, like Mulder, I want to believe, right?
See, I'm the same as you. I mean, I believe that there is, statistically, there is something else there. There has to be. Where the lines are blurred, if you like, is the fact that, is it possible for them to have made it to us?
Sure.
You know, but let's, a friend of mine, you know him, Gregor, you've you spoke to him and you've been on the podcast with us, so you know his...
our irascible friend, Gregor. Lovely irascible friend.
He is adamant there can't be. He often sort of talks, says to me when I say I believe in aliens, this is why, prove it, and I'm like, but see, the thing is there was a time when our technological level meant we couldn't venture further than the shoreline.
Right.
With sailboats. So the only time we could cross continent or large stretches of water was when it froze or, when we developed better technology to sail across the oceans. And I think the space travel is that, it's that all over again, but right, instead of the seas of planet Earth, it's the, the vastness of space. And it's only a matter of time before we develop the technology to go forward. So what's to say that, that doesn't happen? One of the things that, fascinates me about alien theory is the ancient alien theory. I don't know if you've looked into that yourself.
Oh, my dad is a fan. He watches all of the History Channel information that he can about it. I like to think of it as one more of those things that is not an impossibility. The way the Earth churns over in the last 4.8 billion years or so, as much as it churns itself over volcanically, seismically, climate related, there's probably vast amounts of history on this Earth that are lost, that's literally boiled away, right? And so we'll never know, right? Well, what gives us the impression that we can make speculation. There's art that gives that idea from ancient cultures and things like that. But it's not any more improbable than anything else. And it's, I mean, it's entirely likely, is what I'm saying.
There was, I think it was found in London, I'm not sure, but there was a hammer or some form of tool that was found in a dig in London. And it had the composition, it had the look, a design of a modern piece of, you know, metallurgy.
Mm-hmm. Anachronistic.
But when they dated it, it was, I think it was like, I can't remember if it was thousands or millions of years old, but it was
pretty good minute.
The carbon date. Yeah. It was a lot. And nobody's been able to explain it.
Right.
The pyramids of Giza, the pyramids in Mayan society as well.
Right.
The crystal skulls, of course, which was referenced in a...
We don't talk about. Oh, man. That's one of those. That is the These Are the Voyages of the Indiana Jones franchise.
So, but here's the thing, right? One of the things is we dismiss, I mean, not us personally, because we're both, you know, interested in it, but society as a whole generally dismisses the whole alien thing, right? Mm-hmm. And but yet we accept religion.
Right.
Okay. Now this is going somewhere, so stick with me.
I'm with you.
So we embrace religion, but we are skeptical of alien theory. But when you go to, I think it's either Hinduism or... I think it is. I think it's, you know, it's one of the religions from like India and Pakistan and that sort of area of the world. Right. I think it's Hinduism, where it actually is in their texts, their Bibles, if you like, their religious books, mm-hmm. where they directly reference what can be translated as extraterrestrial beings, people flying,
right?
You know, in flying
with
craft,
technology, right?
It's all mentioned there. It's actually in their books that were written all that time ago, and you've got to ask yourself: if we accept religion but dismiss aliens, mm-hmm. yet this religion effectively, even if only in theory, proves the fact.
Sure, yeah.
You know, it's... and you look at other religions and other, like, or other cultures.
There's passages in, you know, the Old Testament / Torah that that describe things that could be ascribed to, you know, flight-capable technology, mm-hmm. or just, you know, fantasticism as well. But... here's the thing, man. Like you said, we accept religion. A lot of us use that as a tool in our lives. But it is no less far-fetched to think that there are who knows how many other advanced cultures out there. And I'm considering ourselves advanced. But I think more to the point is something that religion gives people that you know, maybe this idea of ancient aliens or aliens in general takes away from them is religion tends to, at least, you know, Eurocentric religions like Christianity especially, tend to mm-hmm. center it on yourself, right? And we're selfish and we're egotistical. And so it's all about your own personal relationship. It's your own salvation. It's your own, et cetera, and so on. And what the idea and the, you know, the recognition or validation of the idea of alien life takes the spotlight off of humanity. We're no longer special if there's more things out there than us, right? And that is evident on this planet. We are specious on our very own planet. We have the ego to assume that we're the most advanced and most intelligent species on the planet just because we're upright walking around fucking things up, you know? And so, you know, to my theory, the dolphins got it right and they had the good sense to stay in the water. You know, if Douglas Adams has taught us anything, getting into the trees was a stupid idea. And then we got down. And what was that even about? But yeah, you know, I mean, the thing is, like you said, folks will believe in something with very little evidence to support it versus the statistical absolute possibility. And I mean, it's a fact that life exists other places than Earth. It's no doubting. There's no doubting it. There's no denying it. In an infinite space, the statistical probability dictates that it's happened millions and billions of times. The matter is, do we, you know, it could happen once in a galaxy and still be billions of times, y'all. I mean, if there was only one planet like Earth in every galaxy, that's still a billion Earths. And you just add that up exponentially. We've already found planets, exoplanets, in our own galaxy that are Earth-like and that we can read would have the ability to support Earth-like life. So, you know, if it happened here, as Battlestar said, this has all happened before and it will all happen again. You know, we're not as special as we think, and that gives a lot of people an existential crisis.
I mean, you've got to sort of think about this. We think we're, like you say, big, important, you know, and the ego of humanity is really huge. But when you think about that, it would take hundreds of years with current technology, hundreds of years to get to the nearest inhabitable planet.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that isn't even at the far reaches of the Milky Way.
Right.
That's still relatively, you know,
that's in the neighborhood comparatively. You know,
it's in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So you think that it would take thousands of years, thousands of years to get to the edge of the Milky Way galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And there are,
even if we took the short star trip to systems, the near side of it,
billions of star systems in the galaxy, and then there are just as many galaxies as there is star systems in ours.
Right. So, to illustrate that real quick, if you know, we used to see, before we launched Hubble, we used to see the stars in the sky with our best telescopes here on Earth, the ones that sit up on the mountains with the clear skies, and you know, they just stare into the void for days sometimes. And, you know, all we saw were stars. And we launched the Hubble, and we pointed at that minuscule dot of space. And, you know, it's the Hubble near field image. And we zoom, you don't even have to zoom in. And what we thought were stars in this speck, this tiny speck of space that we stared at with the Hubble, hundreds of galaxies in that one picture. They're not stars, they're galaxies. It's insane. And that's one, like pixel, effectively one pixel. I mean, it's less than a pixel of space. And we just stared at it for days. And we found hundreds of galaxies.
We are essentially a grain of sand.
We're so ignorant.
on Myrtle Beach.
Right? Oh, yeah. It's not even one grain of sand of all the sand on Earth. It's one grain of sand on a particular beach.
One grain of sand.
You know, if you were with all the sand on the Earth, that's everything under the ocean. I mean, yeah, no, we're infinitely insignificant is the way I like to put it, because, it's just reductive theory. At a certain point, you have to just realize that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to say that you are insignificant. You as a person are not, because the reason that it's important to come to that realization that you and humanity overall are completely insignificant is that then you take that knowledge and you use it to be positive and have an effect around you, because JJ, you and I are, you know, here we are, you know, if I took a picture of this screen right now, we're right next to each other, right? But we're thousands of miles apart. But, you know, that it just...
And I'm speaking to you from the future.
Yeah, and you're speaking to me from the future because it's later than it is here. And so now I know what 9 o'clock is going to look like when it gets here. But yeah, it doesn't get any
better,
right? But then you have to understand that you know, once you realize your own insignificance, that the people around you are the only thing that you can have an impact on. You can only control the wind. You don't even really have control of it, but you can only affect the, you know, the 3 to 6 feet around you. And what are you going to do with that, right? It's up to you to make important choices with that, because in the bigger universe, you know, the aliens could show up any day and just remind us of how puny we really are.
I mean, I think that there is a lot more now. I'm not saying this is a conspiracy theory that, oh, you know, we're all being all subjected or anything theories. Like that. But we don't get told everything.
No, okay? God, no. No.
We don't get all the information.
For better or worse, there's people who couldn't handle the truth. That's actually true.
You know what I mean? And the thing is, I mean, Tommy Lee Jones in Men in Black said it perfectly. Mm-hmm. People are smart. Individuals are smart. I'm paraphrasing here, but individuals are smart. People are stupid.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And together by, in large by groups. That, I mean, by that mean, it's the herd mentality.
Yep.
Okay? When one person goes one way, you can tend to find that most of the other people follow suit.
Exactly.
It's the same, you know, it's not a nasty thing to say. It's just, you know, it's a referring to the fact that, you know, most people will follow the herd. And the fact that if we found out there was other life, if we found out there was something other than us, it would scare the hell out of people.
Most likely.
The vast, I mean, you see what happens when gas prices go through the roof.
People will pour gasoline into garbage bags, yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And recently there was news reports which were completely unfounded here in the UK.
And there's more guns than people in America, y'all. So, you know, just sleep on that.
You know, the thing is that this information wouldn't go down well. It would scare the hell out of society. But it's because we've been restricted, because we're not trusted with that information, that I think is holding us back from finding out the truth or discovering the truth, or even, you know, talking about aliens, them coming to us. Because if they do exist, they're watching us. If they're capable of coming to us, just
they
like when
know we're here.
Yeah, just like when people go to Madagascar for the first time and they discovered all these unique creatures that had evolved on this island, you know, completely uniquely to.
Separate
know,
from
every,
everything else.
Everywhere
yeah.
else.
Also yeah. Australia.
We studied them. We studied them. You know, we watched them. We studied them. And we, you know, so what's to say they're not doing it to us?
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
You know what I mean? But the thing is because this information has been kept from us, because we've always seen space and space travel as governmental, as something that the government does, as something that, you know, is paid for by the taxpayer, is done for research and, you know, and stuff like that. It's never really seen as something for all humanity. It's just seen as something that
for all mankind,
does.
You might say.
Exactly. Good reference. But recently, we've had the likes of Jeff Bezos mm-hmm. and Elon Musk mm-hmm. basically, you know, they've performed these, as some people have called them, Gregor included, stunts. Mm-hmm. Now, the recent one Elon Musk did where he sent the all-civilian crew. So it's not the first civilians in space, because civilians have been up into space numerous times.
Right.
And God rest the one didn't come back. But the, you know, this was the first time that every single person on that...
was this on a Dragon crew?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it was Dragon Inspiration 4, I think it was called.
Okay.
So things like that, it's showing the world that, okay, there are some limitations. They still have to make sure that you're, you know, for what they did, you right. have to make sure that you fit. They have to make sure that you meet them, you know, meet certain criteria. But it showed that this isn't just the preserve of military, you know, because
right.
up until
space
now...
Space is not for just countries.
Yeah, and up until now, everybody's had this astronaut thing. It's like, you have to be ex-military, fighter pilots, the best of the best, top gun.
You know, yeah.
Or a scientist, yeah. But this sort of proved that it can be done. It can be done. People can go. And I watched that launch and I filled with excitement when I seen, you know, when I watched the whole thing, but, you know.
Right. Well, honestly, like it's amazing. I'd like to take a moment here and make some clarifications too, because it's easy to conflate, you know, Richard Branson, Jeff Bezos, and Elon Musk into kind of the same group of people. But what we've got to remember is, you know, so far, Bezos and Branson are playing around. They're you know, they're throwing their ball as high into the air as they can, and then they're waiting for it to come down. What SpaceX has done has literally launched cargo and crew to the International Space Station for years now, and they're capable of landing 150-foot rockets on a postage stamp in the middle of the ocean. And so let's not forget let's not forget who's doing space for real right now. And that is, I will qualify that with saying that I think there's a lot of, Elon Musk is a very problematic person. He's not.
Yes. I mean,
there's a whole rabbit hole. We're not going to get into that. I personally, I think he's tends to be mostly harmless, somewhat of a socially inept kind of person, probably because he's autistic like a lot of us. And so, you know, is he genius? No. Has he gotten kind of lucky? Yeah. And, you know, that's not to take anything away from him, because, you know, Steve Jobs got real lucky too. And these are the kind of people who can see the thing but not necessarily make the thing. And so you surround yourself with the right people. But, yeah, let's not get it twisted about who's actually, you know, winning in space and who's still just playing around. And I think it's easy to get that conflated because Musk is currently SpaceX is currently working on spaceship Starship. And, you know, that's been in the news more than, you know, Dragon and what is it? What are the rockets called? Falcon launches and such. And, you know, there's been, I don't think there's been any quite any success with Starship yet, but the idea being, single giant rocket that takes us back to the moon. And, you know, they're closer than the other two guys, I'd say.
I think to be honest, I mean, just to further clarify that, me personally, I agree with everything you just said.
Right.
Now, I'm by no means an Elon Musk fanboy.
Right.
You know, I mean...
No doubt.
But what I will say is that he has developed, with the help of NASA... And NASA, with the help of Elon, they've worked together to basically develop and get to where they are now.
Right.
But to see, the thing is that the NASA was always restricted by government funding. Mm-hmm. It was always restricted by government agendas, by whatever, you know, and it changed from president to president. I mean, the space race, for example.
Once we beat the Russians to the moon, so suddenly there's no money to go to space anymore.
You know? That's it. We've done it. We've beat the Russians.
We've got the reservoir at Hoover Dam full of cash if we can beat the Russians. But once we beat them, we're like, whatever. And then the Cold War's over before the Russians are trying to get to Mars, so we're still not going to Mars. But I guarantee you, if the Cold War had continued and the space race, and, you know, let the Russians. Or the Soviets, I should say, have launched a mission to Mars and see how fast we didn't try and catch up. You know,
I mean the. Or threatened I mean, to. Going back to what you said about the reusable booster rockets, for example, one of the arguments I had with Gregor was the fact that SpaceX has developed has cut the cost of space travel. Mm-hmm. Because what used to cost billions and billions of dollars to put a rocket into space now costs hundreds of thousands of dollars instead of billions of dollars. But honestly, I get excited by the launch. I get excited by the rocket going up there. I love every minute of it. I sit on the edge of my seat. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't stop there. I don't switch off once the rocket's up. I sit there. I wait. I watch the whole process from start to finish, right to the very point at which that, was it 100 feet, maybe more?
Yeah,
cylindrical feet.
Yeah, it's 15 stories
tall. Landing boop. Vertically boop. On a barge in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. Is
Yeah, it's nuts.
It's very graceful. It's so. It's just like kissing your mother. It's like down.
And it's It's one of the things that the shuttle was meant to be able to accomplish was this fast, efficient, reusable launch platform. And, you know, taking away nothing from the glory of the space shuttle, but it didn't quite work out that way.
The space shuttle did a lot of good
work, though. Yeah, yeah.
We can put Elon Musk and SpaceX to one side because they're actually doing something practically commercial. But the other thing as well with that Inspiration 4 is they also, not only was it the first civilian, all civilian crew, but they actually, now this is the bit where it becomes a bit of this is where the showmanship comes in a little bit. So basically most orbits are either on the same plane as the International Space Station or just below it.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the orbits have been in that sort of ballpark area of you know, Earth orbit. But Inspiration 4 went further than the International Space Station. So they were actually orbiting above the International Space Station. So they actually hold now the record for the highest orbit, continuous orbit.
Oh, wow. Very cool.
Planet Earth.
There you go.
So there was that was the only bit of showmanship in there, I think.
That was probably just a quiet little.
Yeah, it's just like, whoa.
You guys are barely getting to technical space, and I'm just going to go just a little bit farther just because I can.
So we'll put Elon Musk to one side, and we'll talk about Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos. Now, they are just basically people throwing money at something to say, I've done this or I've done that, right?
Right, right.
Now, Richard Branson, at best, is going to improve international travel.
Right.
That's the whole idea of Virgin Galactic. It's designed to basically go into suborbital flight and basically get from one side of the world to the other in hours instead of, you know, like a couple of hours instead of 8, 9, 12, 14.
Yeah.
So you could basically do Australia to London in 4 or 5 hours instead of, you know, 24.
Right.
Stuff like that. So we'll now put Branson away. What I want to talk to you, we've been mentioning Star Trek references in For All Mankind. Do you not, and I want to, if there's any Trekkies listening to this podcast, if they're still listening, how many of you genuinely laughed when they found out that William Shatner was going to go into space? Now, not because he was going to go into space, because I think that was amazing and he loved it. And I don't want to take that away from Bill.
Anyway,
You know what I mean? Because he loved it and it was an amazing experience for him. But does anybody get the irony of the fact that William Shatner, Captain James T. Kirk, went into orbit, suborbital flight in a rocket shaped like a
dildo? Yeah. Well, shaped like a dick.
Captain Kirk's dildo.
Yeah. When someone first told me that he was going into space, I was like, what? I hadn't heard of it. And it was like the day before the launch or 2 days before the launch. So I hadn't actually, I'm terrible at paying attention to the news these days. There were a lot of people who wanted to play the, you know, well, actually technically game with William Shatner. And what I would like to say personally, I think William Shatner, the person, has a tendency to be somewhat problematic. He's also 90 fucking years old. So guess what? 90-year-olds are sometimes problematic. And that's okay, because if it weren't for William Shatner, we wouldn't have the kind of franchise that we have today. And that's okay. He's always going to be a part of Trek, and rightfully so. His work as Captain Kirk will always stand the test of time, because it's great. But regardless of how you feel about the man personally or professionally, for a 90-year-old individual to be able to do something that he literally dreamed of because of his job, you know, 50 years on, this man, you know, played a pioneering captain of a far future humanity, which had gotten past all the foibles that we still fight for or fight over. Mm-hmm. Why would you take that away? Why are you just a bad person? Are you just jealous? What is it? Who hurt you that you want to take that away from someone, especially a nonagenarian? and why would you? I mean, and Bill Shatner on top of that. Shut up, you know? Just shut up. Go home.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, to be fair, I mean, if Jeff Bezos wants to throw money at this thing and play space, fair enough.
Guess what? Jeff Bezos, if my next Amazon delivery includes a fucking ticket to space, I'm going to go, and you guys can kiss my ass that it's not real space, you know?
Oh, believe me, if I ever get a notification on my Amazon Prime... that
you've been randomly selected to fly on the dick. You know, I'll be like, you know what? Doesn't look anything like a dick. It's a beautiful spaceship. Let's go.
I would do it in a heartbeat.
Oh, fuck yeah.
I would do it in a heartbeat.
No, I don't know why all of a sudden this is the Sailors podcast. I'm just excited. But yeah, but it's marked explicit. Who cares?
I know who... remembering Generations, the film... Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not everybody's cup of tea.
No, I like it. I like all Star Trek.
But the scene where Captain Kirk dies.
Right. The first time. Okay. In the Nexus.
The first time. Yeah. In the Nexus. The end.
The bridge. The end. The shitty death. Okay.
No, not the shitty death. The one where Picard basically has to, you know, bury him on the.
Oh, with the rocks. Yeah.
The rocks, yeah. Now, that scene, I remember seeing an interview about that scene where he was saying how would Kirk see death? How would he greet death?
Right.
You know, and he basically says it'd be like seeing something for the first time, something amazing, something awe-inspiring. And he went, because in the movie, as you know, he goes,
oh my.
Oh my.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, and I don't know.
You get that sense. I've always felt that sense. And he sells it through his eyes.
He sells it through his eyes. And I tell you what, he nailed it. And I know that now more.
Yep.
After watching the video. So he had
that same sense of wonder in his eyes when he was staring at the earth.
Right. And you hear him in the voice. He was like, oh my.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
You know, it's just.
And that's the thing, man. That is the universal feedback that everyone who gets to see that comes back with. It's like, you don't understand how small it is. You don't understand how fragile it is. You don't understand how connected we are until you can see it. You know, it's the Lily Sloan moment, you know, when she saw Earth from space aboard the Enterprise E, it all resolved very quickly. That, you know, and I think we could advance more quickly as a species if more folks had the opportunity to see Earth from low orbit or even, you know, on a trip to the moon. It's easy to forget that the farthest we've ever gotten from home is 230,000 miles, and people put more on Toyotas all the time. You know?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, people have traveled more miles on the, you know, on you the continent travel, of the United States.
Hey, listen. You do 100 trips across the United States. You've been a trip to the moon, not back. You know, it's 200 trips across the United States. Oh no, it's not. It's like 50 trips because it's 3,000 miles each way. So if you go back and forth, you know, that adds up quick.
See, back to the alien theory, just briefly. I think that's why we haven't been back to the moon. Officially,
something. Yeah, it's called the plot of Star Trek: Dark of the Moon. There's Transformers on the moon.
So the I don't know if you know the stories about intercepted ham radio intercepted conversations with
Buzz
Aldrin.
Yeah.
That were on the medical channel, but managed to get intercepted somehow. And they were talking about there's something up here, there's something watching us.
Oof.
You know, I've seen this thing.
Spooked on the moon, man. Oh.
But I think that's why we haven't been up. I think we're conspiracy theory. I think we're actually still up there.
Dun, dun, dun. Hey, listen, Captain America's on the moon. We've already established that. Steve Rogers is on the moon. That's official canon in the MCU.
Wallace and Gromit as well.
Yeah, of course, of course. Whoever you need to be. The Whalers on the moon from Futurama, they're there now too, you know? So, and with that, maybe we bring it down. JJ, man, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you again, brother. And we'll do a little more next time, man. I think we'll pick something specific to get into. And what I will say is that we rather handily managed to avoid only talking about Star Trek.
Yeah, we only mentioned it a couple of times. I think that was quite impressive.
We're relevant, right? We're relevant. So there's that. But yeah, man, you know, it's always good to see you. It's always good to hear from you. And it's always good to catch up with you. And maybe we won't waste so long next time.
Oh, like I say, anytime, bro. Anytime.
But, you have the distinction of being the trifecta. So you're the first person to be involved in the show for the third time. So.
Oh, really?
You got two episodes of the podcast and one episode on YouTube, man. That's uniquely special. Wow. I know.
Wow.
So there you go.
Do I get a certificate?
Yeah, I'll send you a trophy. I'll send you some piece of paper.
It's just a couple of
official
couple
from
of
the
packets of Hershey's.
Yeah, that's it. Official from the Commodore. but yeah, no, this latest round around the recordings has been a kind of a bring back some all-stars. Last week's episode, as of this recording, last week's episode was the Thrifty Trekkie, and then the upcoming episode is a double feature with Toddy the Space Hottie and Starfleet Boy. So Trek on the Tube and Starfleet Boy are going to be available coming up. And then Runa, who's a new addition to the roster here at Digression Cast, and then yourself coming back the week after that. So when the listeners get to hear this, everything I just said will be completely out of date. So
yeah,
never wibbly wobbly timey wimey. You know what I'm saying? Hold on there now. That's a little wibbly wobbly timey wimey, don't you think?
I think you're dead right there, boy. I think it's gonna apologize right now.
All right now.
I apologize right now.
Right here, let me tell you. For my
poor Southern accent.
Listen, it's a lot better than my piss poor Scottish accent.
Oh, well, to be honest with you, can expect it to improve. But anyway,
it's gonna improve.
Before we go, one thing I would love to do, and I'm gonna say this live on air, is I would love to do an episode with the Treknecks, all three of us, four of us, however many there is.
How many we've round it? Yeah, right? Me and you and Johnny and maybe P.
Yeah, let's get all together and just have a Treknek special. I'd love to do that. You know, just
but the rule is everybody got to stay in their accent though.
I'll have to work on that.
Yeah, ain't no disaffecting your accent so that you sound smarter. Y'all got to get right down into it.
Honestly, I'm never going to be able to set foot in the southern states of the U.S. now because
we'll be
lit.
You know, you best keep it walking, boy. No, I'd get you in. I get a plus one. It's fine. All right, JJ, man. We're going to keep this going if I don't stop. And I've actually got to take kids and pick kids up and do stuff like that. Which you're well versed in as yourself. So go ahead and plug your shows, man. Let the listeners know where else they can find you on the regular.
Okay, so at the moment I have a new podcast going, which is just me talking about various memories and life aspects of working on the buses, being a bus driver, my life and stories up to press. It's just me talking about me. it's just me talking about the buses. Check it out. If it's not for you, it's not for you. But if it is, like I say, by all means, come on.
Yeah, there it's, may be some ASMR in there as well. You never know.
There very may well be.
A podcast talk about his talking about his buses.
Oh, you were going all yes.
Get that ASMR.
Yes. Where's the dinosaurs? That was bad.
That's okay. So that is what's the name of this one? Because
it is called "I'll Get You Butler." So I'll get you Butler, and it's you can follow it on Twitter at IGB_podcast. You can also follow me at Albert Android if you wish. We do have Spock of the Week as well, which we have plugged before on the show. But at the moment, we are currently taking a little bit of a break for reasons we will not go into here. But you can follow them at Spock Week on Twitter as well. And any information about when the show comes back on will be on the Twitter. So at Spock Week, at Albert Android, and at IGB_podcast. That's where you can find my shows and myself.
Right on. So, but back up real quick. Explain to me that title. I get you, Butler.
Butler.
Yeah.
Run
it out for me.
I'm going to give you some homework and your listeners some homework as well. There is a sitcom from the UK, which was called On the Buses. Okay. And the main character was Stan Butler. The sort of evil character, not evil character, the sort of the bad guy character, if you like, the you know, there's always one guy that ever, yes, was a inspector, a ticket, you know, an inspector, which was...
It's all coming together now.
His catchphrase was, "I'll get you, Butler." That's honestly, right?
I love it.
So,
I love it.
Your homework.
I'm going to have to subscribe to BritBox, aren't I?
Yes. All of you on there. Or you'll have to show me how to upload things to Plex and I'll get it to you that way. But there's plenty of clips on YouTube. Search for it on YouTube, have a look, and that'll give you an idea. So there is a story behind, because my handle when I first started on the buses was Butler because of that show.
Nice.
So
comes full circle.
That will be explained at some point. Yes. Yeah, so that's the reason for it. But apparently I do have downloads from the US already.
Hey, awesome. That's awesome.